Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine a sport where the pitch is precisely measured, yeah?
Right.
But the actual playing field could be almost circular or this massive sprawling oval, and a game, right, that can go on for 5 whole days and still end up as a draw.
It sounds pretty strange when you put it like that.
It does. Think about it. Hitting a six at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, which is colossal, takes way more power than, say, lofting one for six at Feroz Shah Kotla in Delhi.
Absolutely. Different grounds, different demands for the same result.
It's just a glimpse into the fascinating world of cricket, a sport with some really unique peculiarities.
And what's fascinating here is that these characteristics, they aren't just quirks, are they? They're reflections, really, of cricket's deep social and historical roots, kind of baked right in.
Okay.
If we, connect them to the bigger picture, it tells us a whole lot about the society it grew up in and then how it spread around the world.
Exactly. And that's pretty much our mission today. We've got this stack of sources, you shared articles, some research notes, and we're going on a deep dive into the history of cricket. We'll trace its evolution, yeah, from English country commons all the way to this global televised spectacle.
And uncover how its very nature was shaped by things like social class, colonialism, technology.
Right. Get ready for some aha
Yeah.
moments, because this is a sport that's so much more than just bats and balls.
Definitely.
So let's start at the beginning. Cricket's English roots. A really peculiar start, wouldn't you say? Back in the 18th, 19th centuries.
Oh, absolutely. It stands out quite dramatically from, well, almost any other modern team sport when you look at those core characteristics.
Okay, like what?
Well, the first thing that always jumps out is the duration. We mentioned it, but a test match running for 5 days
5 days.
and still potentially no winner,
Huh.
a draw, compare that to football, 90 minutes, and usually there's a result.
It's a huge difference. And then there's the playing area we touched on. The pitch itself, absolutely fixed,
Right.
22 yards, no question.
Standardized, yeah.
But the ground, the outfield, the size, the shape, it's completely undefined in the rules.
Which leads to those contrasts, like Adelaide Oval versus Chepauk in Chennai. One's a huge oval, the other almost circular.
Eating that six at Melbourne needs a massive hit compared to Feroz Shah Kotla in Delhi. Same 6 runs, totally different effort.
It's a really remarkable contrast. And these things were set pretty early on. The first written laws of cricket, they date back to 1744.
1744, okay.
Yeah.
What did they establish?
Key stuff. Umpires, chosen from gentlemen present, they decided disputes. The stumps were set at 22 inches high with a 6-inch bail across the top,
Right.
and the ball had to be between 5 and 6 ounces. Even things like betting, the norms around it were formalized in those early laws.
Wow, betting right from the start. And these laws kept changing, didn't they? They didn't just stay static.
Oh no, they evolved. The ball weight got refined, narrowed down to 5.5 to 5.75 ounces, and the bat width had to be limited to 4 inches.
Why was that? Was there a specific incident?
There was. Apparently, a batsman turned up with a bat literally as wide as the wicket, so they had to put a stop to that.
Okay, makes sense.
What else? 1774 saw the first leg before law, LBW, crucial rule, stops batsmen just patting the ball away. And around then, the third stump became common practice too, made bowling more effective.
And the match length, did that change?
By 1780, yeah, major matches were stretching to 3 days. And that same year, the first six-seam cricket ball was created.
Ah, the seam.
Ah,
That's vital for swing and spin, isn't it?
hugely important. And it's still the standard. Then the 19th century brought more rules about wide balls, specifying the exact circumference of the ball.
Protective gear started coming in too.
Yes, pads, gloves, boundaries were introduced before that. You had to run every single hit.
Everything. Wow.
And a big one, overarm bowling, was finally legalized. That changed the game dramatically.
So lots of evolution in the rules and equipment.
Yeah.
But you mentioned something interesting earlier about it being fundamentally pre-industrial, even though it was maturing during the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly. Its origins really shaped its soul, you could say.
How so?
It started on country commons, public land, usually unfenced.
Okay.
And because the size of these commons varied so much, there were no fixed boundaries, which explains why, even today, the size and shape of the ground aren't defined in the laws. It's a direct link back.
That makes sense. And the materials, you
Yeah.
mentioned bats and balls.
All natural, pre-industrial stuff. Wood for the bat, the stumps, the bails, leather, twine, cork for the ball.
And the really amazing thing is, they're still handmade today, not mass-produced.
Pretty much. The bat and ball, the core tools, are still crafted by hand. It's quite unique in modern sport.
Did the materials change at all over time? The bat, maybe?
The bat did evolve slightly. It used to be one solid piece of wood. Now it's two, a willow blade, which is traditional, and a cane handle.
Cane, where'd that come from?
That became available through trade and colonialism, actually. European companies and colonialists in Asia made cane accessible.
Ah, okay. But here's where it gets really interesting, isn't it? Cricket's resistance to modern materials.
Yes. Unlike, say, golf or tennis, which embraced new technology, cricket really dug its heels in. Plastic, fiberglass, metal, all firmly rejected for the core equipment.
And there's a famous story about Dennis Lilly, the Australian bowler.
That's the one. He came out to bat with an aluminum bat in a match, caused a huge fuss. The umpires conferred and basically said, nope, not allowed. It was outlawed pretty much immediately.
It really shows that deep connection to its past, doesn't it? And that past is very tied up with Victorian English society.
Absolutely central. Particularly this whole distinction between amateurs and professionals.
Right. The gentlemen versus the players. Can you unpack that a bit?
Sure. The gentlemen were the rich amateurs. They played for fun, for leisure. It was seen as an aristocratic value not to play for money.
And the players?
They were the professionals, often from poorer backgrounds, playing for their livelihood.
And this wasn't just a label, it reflected a real social hierarchy.
Oh, completely. Amateurs were literally called gentlemen. Professionals were just players. They even used different gates to enter the cricket ground.
Wow. So how did this distinction actually affect the game itself? Like, who did what on the field?
Well, there was a tendency for the gentlemen, the amateurs, to gravitate towards batting. It was seen as the more, well, gentlemanly pursuit.
Leaving the harder work.
Exactly. The physically demanding stuff, like fast bowling, that often fell to the professionals, the players. This bias is probably one reason why the rules often seem to favor the batsmen slightly.
Interesting. And the captaincy. Who led the team?
Traditionally, the captain had to be a gentleman, usually a batsman, not necessarily because they were the best tactical mind, but because of their social standing.
So status over skills sometime.
You could argue that. It took until the 1930s for England to have its first professional test captain, the great Yorkshire batsman Len Hutton. That was a big moment.
This all feeds into that famous saying, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton.
Ah, yes. The myth.
The idea that Britain's power came from character built playing games like cricket at elite schools.
It's a powerful narrative, but if you look at the actual history... Well, the Napoleonic Wars were won largely because of Britain's economic strength.
You mean industry?
Yeah, the ironworks in Scotland and Wales, the textile mills in Lancashire, the financial power of the City of London. Britain's lead in trade and industry was the real engine of its global power.
So the playing fields of Eton, a bit of a romantic notion.
It definitely raises that question, doesn't it? How often do societies create these kinds of stories to explain their success rather than looking at the maybe less glamorous economic or structural reasons?
That's a really deep point. Makes you think about how nations tell their own stories. Maybe it applies elsewhere, too.
Could well do.
And it's especially relevant when we think about how this society and its games spread across the world. Because interestingly, cricket didn't travel like, say, football did.
No, it really didn't. While games like hockey and football went truly global, cricket stayed largely a colonial game.
Limited to countries that were once part of the British Empire.
Pretty much exclusively. That pre-industrial oddness we talked about, the long duration, the quirky rules.
Yeah.
It made it harder to just export wholesale. It really only took root where the British actually conquered and ruled.
And even then, how it took root varied, right?
Yeah. In places like South Africa, Zimbabwe, Australia, New Zealand, the West Indies, Kenya, it was largely established by white settlers.
Okay.
But in India, it was more a case of local elites consciously adopting the habits of their colonial rulers, copying their masters, essentially.
But did the British actively try to spread it to everyone in the colonies?
Not really. There was very little effort made by imperial officials to encourage non-white populations to play, especially in India and the West Indies.
So playing cricket became, what, a status symbol?
Exactly. A sign of superior social and racial status. In the Caribbean, for instance, the Afro-Caribbean population was often actively discouraged from organized club cricket that was dominated by the white plantation owners and maybe their servants.
It's quite stark. So when did non-white players start forming their own clubs?
In the West Indies, the first non-white club didn't appear until late in the 19th century. And even then, its members were mainly light-skinned mulattoes. It highlights the divisions.
But despite all that exclusion, The game became hugely popular in the Caribbean, didn't it?
Exploded in popularity. And after independence, it took on this massive symbolic importance. Leaders like Forbes Burnham in Guyana, Eric Williams in Trinidad, they saw cricket as a way to assert national pride.
A chance for self-respect on the world stage.
Precisely. And that moment when the West Indies beat England in a test series for the first time back in the 1950s.
Must have been huge.
Oh, it was celebrated as this massive national achievement, a statement of equality, proof that they were the equals of the English.
A powerful story. And India. You mentioned the elites adopting it. How did it start there?
The very beginning of Indian cricket, played by Indians, that is, was in Bombay. And the first community to really take it up were the Parsis.
The Zoroastrian community. Why them specifically?
Well, they were heavily involved in trade, which brought them into close contact with the British early on. So they were among the first Indian communities to sort of westernize.
Right.
They founded the first Indian cricket club, the Oriental Cricket Club, in Bombay way back in 1848.
And they got funding from big Parsi business families.
Yeah, like the Tatas and the Wadias. But the established white cricket elite, they offered zero help to these Parsi pioneers.
Really? No support at all?
Worse than that, there was active rivalry. A big quarrel broke out between the Bombay Gymkhana, a whites-only club, and the Parsi cricketers.
What about?
About using a public park. The Parsis complained that the Bombay Gymkhana's polo ponies were digging up the pitch, making it unfit for cricket.
Polo ponies versus cricket. And the authorities sided with...
They were clearly prejudiced in favor of the white club, so the Parsis realized they wouldn't get a fair shake.
So what did they do? Give up?
No way! They built their own gymkhana, their own private club to play cricket in, a real act of self-reliance and defiance, too.
That's fantastic. And did they ever get their own back on the Bombay Gymkhana?
They did. There's a sort of happy ending here. In 1889, a Parsi team actually beat the Bombay Gymkhana at cricket.
Brilliant. And that timing is interesting. 1889.
Yeah, just 4 years after the Indian National Congress was founded in 1885. And one of the key early leaders of the Congress was Dadabhai Nauroji, a great Parsi statesman himself. There are connections there.
So the Parsi Gymkhana set a precedent.
Absolutely. Other Indian communities saw what they'd done and followed suit. Soon you had clubs forming based on religious community.
Aye.
By the 1890s, Hindus and Muslims were fundraising for a Hindu gymkhana and an Islam gymkhana.
Yeah, the British authorities, were they okay with this?
They actually encouraged it. In a way, it fit their view of India as just a collection of separate communities, not one nation. So they were quick to recognize these communal institutions, foster divisions, you could say.
Mm. Complex dynamics. It's interesting, given all this, what did someone like Mahatma Gandhi think about cricket?
Yeah, that's worth touching on. Gandhi believed sport was vital, you know, for balancing mind and body, but he was often critical of cricket and hockey specifically.
Why? Because they were British imports.
Partly that, yeah. He saw them as games for the privileged few, games that sort of pushed aside traditional Indian sports.
And reflected a colonial mindset.
Exactly. He felt they weren't really active enough compared to, say, the physical work of farmers, and didn't serve the broader needs or identity of Indians, a sort of colonial hangover. So, given these complex origins, these critiques, how did cricket make the leap to the global game we see now?
Right. That brings us to the modern era, dominated by test matches and, of course, one-day internationals.
Yeah.
Played between national teams.
And the status of test cricket remained huge, didn't it? Even as other forms emerged.
Oh, definitely. Think of someone like C.K. Naidu. He was a brilliant Indian batsman. Maybe past his absolute peak by then, but he's remembered because he captained India in its first test matches in 1932.
Well, other great players from that time.
Are largely forgotten, yeah. Because their careers didn't quite overlap with India playing tests, it conferred that historical status.
And it's key to remember, India started playing tests in 32, a full 15 years before independence.
How is that possible?
Because test cricket wasn't originally conceived as games between independent nations. It started in 1877 as contests between different parts of the British Empire.
Ah, like England versus Australia, when Australia was still a colony.
Exactly. Not sovereign nations, but that imperial structure was obviously changing.
Right. Decolonization must have had a massive impact.
Oh, inevitably. Starting with India's independence in 1947, you see this gradual decline of British influence across the board, and that included sport. It fundamentally began to reshape the international landscape of cricket.
And alongside that political shift, you get this huge technological revolution, particularly television.
TV changed everything. On the field, you started getting things like the third umpire.
With slow motion replays from every angle.
Yeah, cameras actually in the stumps, umpires wearing microphones, much better electronic scoreboards.
And off the field.
Things just got slicker, organizing matches, information flow. But yeah, the biggest impact was television's commercial power.
Right. This is a huge takeaway, isn't it? TV made cricket marketable. Suddenly, it was a way to make serious money.
Cricket boards got rich selling broadcast rights. TV channels made fortunes selling advertising slots during matches.
Because they had this huge captive audience watching for hours, sometimes days.
Exactly. Companies lined up to sell everything to cricket fans, and the players...
became celebrities overnight, practically.
Yeah. Paid way better by their boards, sure, but then earning even more from endorsements, advertising everything from tires to soft drinks.
And TV didn't just reach the cities, did it?
No, that's crucial. It took cricket into small towns, into villages, places that had never seen top-level international cricket live before.
Broadening the social base. Kids can watch their heroes and try to copy them.
Mm-hmm. And then satellite TV came along, multinational broadcasters, that created a truly global market for the game. Sealed the deal.
And you absolutely cannot talk about this TV transformation without mentioning one name. Kerry Packer.
Ah, the Australian TV tycoon. Yes, he saw the potential before almost anyone else. Cricket as televised entertainment, ripe for profit.
And he launched World Series cricket, right? Caused a massive storm.
Huge storm. He basically signed up 51 of the world's best cricketers against the wishes of all the official cricket boards and staged his own unofficial tests and one-day series for a couple of years.
But his real legacy wasn't just shaking things up. It was the innovations he brought in specifically for TV, wasn't it?
Exactly. Things we take for granted now. Colored clothing instead of just white. Protective helmets becoming standard. Field restrictions to encourage attacking play.
Playing under floodlights. Day-night cricket.
All Packer innovations, designed to make the game more visually appealing, more dramatic for television viewers, and they stuck.
So the key lesson Packer drove home was?
That cricket was a marketable product, that it could generate massive revenues if packaged correctly for TV. That changed the entire financial basis of the sport forever.
And one major consequence of all this, the decolonization, the TV money, the global market, is that the old power center of cricket shifted.
Definitely. It moved away from that traditional London-Melbourne axis, the Anglo-Australian dominance.
How do we see that shift?
Well, one clear sign is where innovation and technique started coming from. Increasingly, it was from the subcontinent.
India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm. Think about Pakistan pioneering things like the Dusra.
The mystery ball that spins the wrong way for an off-spinner.
Exactly. Baffled batsmen. And reverse swing, getting an old, roughed-up ball to swing unpredictably, often late.
Both were revolutionary tactics. How are they received initially?
With a lot of suspicion, particularly from places like England and Australia. There were accusations, you know, that it was somehow unfair, maybe even illegal bending of the rules.
A bit of resistance to change from the old guard.
You could say that. But eventually the reality sunk in. The laws couldn't just be interpreted based on conditions in England or Australia anymore.
The game was global now.
Precisely. So those techniques, the Dusra, reverse swing, they became accepted, part of the toolkit for bowlers everywhere.
So pulling all these threads together, what does this tell us about cricket's landscape today? Where has this journey led?
It means the global marketplace has completely transformed things. Today, Indian players are often the best paid, certainly the most famous cricketers on the planet. The world really is their stage now. The balance of power has decisively shifted.
Phew. Okay, that was quite a journey. From like a quirky village game on some random patch of common land to this multi-billion dollar global spectacle. This deep dive really shows how cricket isn't just a sport. It's like a living museum exhibit of social history, colonialism, technology.
It really is.
It's incredible how it's constantly adapted, or maybe forced others to adapt to it.
Indeed. And what's fascinating, I think, is how those seemingly rigid traditions, the handmade tools, the five-day matches, all that history, they've actually proved remarkably flexible. The game has adapted to different cultures, to the demands of modern media, in ways you might not expect.
That's a really interesting point, that apparent rigidity hides a flexibility.
Which maybe raises a broader question for us, doesn't it? In this age of, you know, instant everything, constant technological change, are there other traditional institutions, things we think of as old-fashioned or fixed, that might actually hold a similar hidden potential for transformation? Are we maybe missing that adaptability elsewhere?
That's a great thought to leave people with. that hidden potential in tradition. So the next time you catch a cricket match, or even just hear the score, maybe you'll see more than just the runs and wickets.
Mm-hmm. The echoes of the gentlemen and the players.
The shadow of empire.
The bright lights of television.
It's all in there. So what stands out to you, you, listening now, about how a single game can reflect so much of the world around it? Something to definitely mull over until our next deep dive.